Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. 2 years from the election of Pope Benedict XVI, we attempt to paint a fitting, though most certainly partial, portrait of Joseph Ratzinger, the man and the pontiff. Father Jim Brand exhorts us to work to discern the will of God, something we can do in many great and small ways. It's been 2 years since, on April 19th, 2005, Cardinal Medina Esteves appeared on the balcony overlooking St. Peter's Square to reveal the name of the newly elected Pope, Joseph Ratzinger, the Church's first German pontiff since the 11th century, who chose for himself the name Benedict XVI. We've been celebrating Pope Benedict with intensity this week, as both his birthday and the anniversary of his election fall within a few days of each other. Obviously, for us here at Vatican Radio, he's a household name and we follow his every move. But what do others think and feel? My colleague, Chris Altieri, decided to pop down to St. Peter's Square to find out.
I think we need him in, you know, what's going on in the world right now.
Oh, I think it's wonderful to be here, and I am... yeah, really enjoying what the Pope is doing now. I live in Switzerland, and so we follow it quite closely from there.
I think he's a very intellectual person, and he tried to reach out.
For myself, I believe he's brought some good order into the Church. So that's for me, it's very good to see that.
This American lady is just one of the many who expressed pleasant surprise at Pope Benedict XVI, and who expressed also a desire to know him better.
I understand that he's been a good pope. He's new, and seemingly he's doing what needs to be done for the people to get to know him. But I don't know him as well as I'd like to know him.
Being in the square today was absolutely fantastic. I really haven't paid that much attention to this pope. We are not Catholic. We're visitors from America. But being here was a real thrill, and we were most impressed.
He certainly seems like a very deep, holy man. Of course, we're not as familiar with him as John Paul, who we loved. We're still learning about him.
I think he had a hard act to follow, and I think he's being himself and doing the best he can.
He's doing a wonderful job.
This young priest from the United States seemed to give the sum of the sentiments of the faithful when he expressed his thankfulness to God for Pope Benedict's election.
We visited the Sistine Chapel this morning, and I was recounting that experience of the election of Pope Benedict this morning in the Sistine Chapel. It is remarkable. One of the greatest blessings of his papacy, I believe, is he is continuing to confirm the faith of the people of God, that is the Church. And every time I hear him speak, I am so thankful and grateful to the Lord that he has called him to continue the legacy of the See of Peter.
Yes, 2 years on, the eyes of the world are on the man who described himself as a simple, humble worker in God's vineyard. Analysts and journalists are weighing up and scrutinizing his pontificate so far, assessing whether expectations have been fulfilled or not, pondering his words and examining his writings in the attempt to paint a fitting portrait of the 264th successor of Peter. Jesuit writer and theologian Father Jerry O'Collins says he thinks Pope Benedict really seems to be carrying through with his very first message, the one he pronounced during his inauguration mass on April 24th, 2005.
I remember with gratitude how he ended by saying, "If we let Christ into our lives, we lose nothing, absolutely nothing, of what makes life free, beautiful, and great."
Chi fa entrare Cristo non perde nulla, nulla, assolutamente nulla di ciò che rende la vita libera, bella e grande.
And since then, in these last 2 years, he's really set himself to show that Jesus Christ is good news for all human beings, and that Jesus does make lives, our lives, truly free, beautiful and great.
In fact, when Joseph Ratzinger was elected, he was already one of the world's most renowned theologians. And Father O'Collins, who also has a personal memory of the man, says the coherence and continuity of his thought are a hallmark of his life.
I remember him 40 years ago. I lived next door to him at the University of Tübingen and heard him lecture. And I remember in particular a very lovely lecture on the Eucharist, in which he set himself to show how the Eucharist is both sacrifice and meal. It was a lecture that had a beginning, a middle, and an end. It was beautifully orchestrated. And I think he's been doing that kind of thing as Pope. He's been preaching and speaking very well in a way that's clear and well-organized. And so there's a kind of direct line then from his pedagogical skills as a theologian professor and what he's been doing as a pontiff.
John Allen, senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter and author of a recently published book on Pope Benedict XVI, agrees. He says that Benedict the theologian is an important and integral part of Benedict the Pope.
Well, I think the first thing to recall is that Benedict XVI is one of the virtuoso Catholic theologians of the 20th and now the 21st century. This is a man who loves and relishes the life of the mind, and I think the thoughtfulness and the intellectual depth that he brings to bear has become increasingly clear over these 2 years. I think anyone who has studied his texts, his documents, his messages, his public addresses, has been struck by the intellectual richness, the fact that that he is able to take extraordinarily complex ideas and yet express them in these kind of limpid Teutonic sentences that are just eminently clear and accessible to all.
Now, whilst a theologian like Father O'Collins, as he himself mentioned right at the start, sees nothing but continuity in Pope Benedict's vision, the journalist John Allen points out that to the eyes of most there has been a surprising disjunction between the early expectations of what this papacy would bring and what we've seen happen over these 2 years.
You know Benedict's public profile prior to his election. Many people saw him as sort of the Darth Vader of the Roman Catholic Church, and there was an expectation that there would be a kind of sharp ideological tone to the papacy. In fact, what we've seen for the most part has been a papacy that is surprisingly gradual, surprisingly centrist, surprisingly pastoral. Obviously, this pope is determined to be as positive as possible and to emphasize his role as a pastor rather than a kind of secular ideological figure. In terms of the impact to date, I think perhaps 2 years in is a bit early to say, but it seems what Benedict wants to do is he wants to promote what Secretary of State Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone defined as a consolidation of Catholic identity, that is a kind of new focus, a return to the pastoral basics of Catholic life, of what makes Catholics distinct in a highly secular world. But he wants to do that in a way that is positive and pastoral rather than narrow and rigid. And I think if you had to put it all in a nutshell, I think what he is trying to promote is a new appreciation of the relationship between reason and faith. That is, that reason without faith becomes skepticism, faith without reason becomes extremism, and therefore these two things belong essentially together.
Yes, reason and faith, a theological concept that comes up again and again as we follow the work of Pope Benedict XVI. And you'll probably remember, it was within a discourse during a visit to Germany that regarded just that topic that a misunderstanding in the Muslim world triggered a series of tragic events and controversies. Controversies, John Allen says, that the Pope has done much to iron out.
I think in terms of the Christian-Muslim relationship and what impact the Regensburg episode may have had on it, I think it's probably too early to say what the long-term fallout is going to be. Clearly, the Holy Father's trip to Turkey in November and early December did a great deal to heal those wounds. I think clearly it got the Christian-Muslim dialogue back on track. But where that may go from here is at this point, I think, still unclear. But I think one of the real tragedies of the Regensburg episode is that if you read carefully the lecture that the Holy Father gave, really was not about Islam at all. I think, unfortunately, the quotation, the 14th century Byzantine emperor quotation regarding Muhammad, with which the Pope chose to open that lecture, sort of distracted our attention from really what the heart of it was. And the heart of it was a kind of synthesis of, I would say, almost 50 years of reflection on the part of Joseph Ratzinger about the symbiosis that he perceives, that is the necessary, essential relationship between reason and faith. Ultimately, therefore, what he was trying to offer in Regensburg was not a critique of Islam. It was, in some ways, a critique of currents in the West that would separate these two things, currents both in the broader culture and also, to some extent, within the church. And I think, therefore, in some ways, that the point he was actually trying to make in Regensburg is still waiting to get its day in court.
But it is, John Allen reiterates, in his speeches, documents and teachings, where we must look to find exactly who this Pope is. He tells us which, he thinks, are the most significant.
Well, ironically, I think probably one could make an argument that his most important lecture to date was precisely the one in Regensburg, but not because of what he said about Islam, but because of the argument he was making about reason and faith. I mean, this was a lecture that was delivered to representatives of the world of science and culture in the university pulpit where Father Joseph Ratzinger had once himself been a lecturer. And I think in many ways it represented a synthesis, an extremely articulate, profound synthesis of his deepest intellectual concerns. And I think perhaps only now do we have enough distance from the immediate reaction in the Muslim world that that lecture can actually be appreciated for what it was. Now, in addition, clearly, I think his first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, has to be mentioned, both because of its content, but also its tone. The content, of course, was about the expression of Christian love, both in the context of a human erotic love, its most intimate form, but also the kind of institutional expressions of love of the church and its charitable and social activities and so on. And all of that is quite important, but I think perhaps even more important is the fact that the Pope addressed these subjects in a way that wasn't disciplinary, and it wasn't seeking new anathema, but it was remarkably positive, open, embracing, warm. And I think what Benedict was after in that encyclical was trying to make a very simple point, which is that too often when Christians address these kinds of subjects, all the world hears us say is no. No to this, no to that, and that as important as those no's may sometimes be, we have to rediscover the capacity to articulate the deeper yes to the most profound sense of the meaning and dignity of human life that underlies all of those specific positions. And I think that model for how the church ought to articulate its teaching, very positive, affirming model, is very important. Beyond that, I think that the catechetical teaching that the Holy Father has been providing in his Wednesday general audiences, just week after week, is extraordinarily rich. It is biblical and it's patristic, but it is not technical theology. It is catechesis in the classical sense. It's accessible to all, yet very profound. And I think, over time, what will happen is that catechists and directors of religious education and people involved in Catholic education will come to rely on these texts, not only to use them in classes and in discussion groups, but also as a model, really, of how teaching ought to be done.
Father O'Collins agrees it's not just highbrow theology flying over most people's heads at all.
Well, I remember some faithful in Italy before I came to live here in London. They appreciated his very helpful catechetical homily, so there was a nice impact on them, these Italian Catholics living there in Rome. And elsewhere, I think some people are grateful to have less enormous action. John Paul II was doing strikingly new things at a tremendous rate in his heyday, and people felt it was like they were being led by an extraordinary figure, but life can be a lot quieter than that. And so I think Pope Benedict's giving people a chance to take it easy, or else to do things on the local level. I think Pope John Paul II was such a very forceful figure that he kind of overshadowed bishops around the world, Benedict's allowing bishops to be what they're called to be by Christ, to be, you know, leaders of their own people, to be vicars of Christ on the local scene.
Yes, a comparison with Pope John Paul II is inevitable, isn't it? But what Pope Benedict XVI seems to be saying with his every move is that he's just Pope Benedict, with his own personality and his own way of doing things. And the best way to get to know and to love him is maybe to sit quietly and pay attention to the wisdom of his words.
Well, I think from the broad public, the most surprising thing is that he's simply not the guy they thought the Catholic Church had elected. You know, again, the expectation was that this was going to be, you know, God's Rottweiler and the German Shepherd and all of that. I think people expected a kind of Reagan revolution in the Catholic Church where the goalposts would be moved significantly to the right. And that simply has not been the tone that he has set. If you look at his major appointments, both in dioceses around the world, but also in the Vatican, you know, there's no clear ideological pattern. He has appointed people who represent kind of all the schools and currents in the church. Nor has there been a kind of sharp lurch in policy. There's been no great disciplinary crackdown, and on and on. He has shown himself to be much more the pastor than the head knocker. Now, those who knew Joseph Ratzinger privately and who'd had occasion to deal with him, I think, are not at all surprised by that, but it clearly has contradicted his sort of public image as a bull in a china shop. At another level, perhaps the most surprising thing to many people is that this has been a more gradual pontificate, a kind of go-slow pontificate. You know, many of us, for example, had expected that there would be rather more dramatic changes in the Roman Curia towards a kind of downsizing and house cleaning. I think what has become clear is that his determination is to go slow, to consult, to act collegially, not to impose his own vision on things right out of the box. And I suppose there the surprise is that, you know, the Pope told us this is what he was going to do in his installation mass on April 24th, 2005. He said that he had been elected not to pursue his own agenda, but to listen carefully with the entire church so that we might discern together the will of the Lord. And I suppose at that level the surprise is he clearly meant what he said.
To listen carefully with the entire church so that we may discern together the will of the Lord. And in that same discourse, Pope Benedict XVI also very clearly said that he intended to set out with the sole concern of proclaiming the living presence of Christ to the whole world. But what, I asked John Allen and Jerry O'Collins, is his deepest concern whilst doing just that?
Well, I think if you were to boil it all down, the deepest concern of Pope Benedict XVI, and this builds upon the deepest concern of Joseph Ratzinger, was again expressed in that memorable phrase from the Mass Pro Eligendo Papa of April 18th, which is the dictatorship of relativism. That is, that the contemporary world, especially the contemporary West, has sort of abandoned the notion that there is any such thing as objective truth. And they've done so in the name of tolerance, thinking that it's a kind of virtuous thing. But in reality, Ratzinger and now Benedict XVI believe that when you abandon the notion of truth, you open the door to all kinds of abuse, because in the absence of truth, the only reality is power, the will to power, and that you can justify all kinds of horrors in the name of the will to power. And so I think it's his effort is to try to promote the notion of truth. Bear in mind his motto, of course, is cooperatores veritatis, co-workers of the truth. And to do that, I think he intends to promote a kind of recovery or a consolidation of Catholic identity, so that in the first place the agenda is to try to foster a kind of deep, intentional Catholicity among the members of the Church, however few or however many they may be, that will then embolden us to share in this task of being co-workers for the truth, because I think he believes that the recovery of belief in truth is the absolute core of any recovery of decency and dignity in modern culture.
Pope Benedict's very concerned about Africa, and you know, he speaks out for for Darfur and all these places that are just simply bleeding in our world down there in Africa. He's very concerned to try to carry the message of peace and stop the scourge of war. And he wants to convince people, as his predecessor did, that war is never a solution. So those would be two big concerns. And a further concern, of course, he lives there in Europe as Bishop of Rome, and it's a big concern to try to stop the religious and moral slide in Europe. Europe's never had it as good. It's enjoying a prosperity that's unprecedented, and I think he's concerned to try to rally people to the fundamental beliefs that make life, you know, truly beautiful and great.
The fundamental beliefs that make life truly beautiful and great. Those are the words Father O'Collins picked out right at the beginning of this program. And that's what Pope Benedict is doing, John Allen points out, in his own gentle and personal way.
I would put it this way. I think that a lot of pundits and the chattering classes in the church, and outside it for that matter, have spent much of these first 2 years waiting for the real Benedict XVI to emerge from beneath this patient, gradual, pastoral, and moderate facade. 2 years on, I would dare suggest that that facade is the real Pope. That is to say, what we've seen over the course of these 2 years is pretty much what we are likely to get from here on out.
Friend Father Jim Brand, spiritual director of the Pontifical Beda College, explains that each and every one of us can and must work to discern the will of God, something we can do in many great and small ways.
Hello, it's Father Jim. God planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put us to care for it. Gardening is one of my great hobbies. Spend a lot of time on my knees. Do all the plants at the college in Rome from seeds and cuttings. I love to touch my Mother Earth. There's a beautiful song, chapter 5 of the prophecy of Isaiah, about Israel being a vineyard. Let me sing to my friend the song of his love for his vineyard. My friend had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug the soil, cleared it of stones, and planted choice vines in it. And in the middle he built a tower. He dug a press there too. But he expected it to yield grapes, but sour grapes were all that it gave. So I ask you to judge between my vineyard and me. What could I have done for my vineyard that I haven't done? I expected it to yield grapes. Why did it yield sour grapes instead? Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I'll take away its hedge for it to be grazed on and knock down its wall for it to be trampled on. I'll lay it waste, unpruned, undug, overgrown by the briar and the thorn. I will command the clouds to rain no rain on it. How disappointing for a gardener, when we do all we can. Now Israel is littered with stones, and to make it fertile it's taken centuries. First of all picking up the stones, then trying to water it, and then give it nourishment, and then planting. By the way, a vine needs good pruning, otherwise it will kill itself if it tried to bud on all its shoots. And our Lord said, if he's the vine and we're the branches, we need pruning, not to hurt us, but to produce more fruit. We've got roses in the garden. It's kind to a rose to prune it so that it doesn't exhaust itself. And we're all so gifted, we couldn't possibly flourish on all our gifts. One lifetime wouldn't be enough. In fact, if I didn't believe in something better, I'd like to believe in reincarnation. I'd love to come back for more. be somebody else, do something else, fall in love deeper, learn more, visit other places. Because one lifetime isn't really enough, it seems, for life to the full. So before any politician went green, God is green. He planted a garden and there he asked us to look after it. And when you think of the violent history this earth has had, geology and astronomy are one of my hobbies. And when you think in the 4,500 million years, the history of the earth, oh, it had been crushed and remolded so many times. And it's taken all those millions of years for the earth to put down her larder. Larder of oil. And the sad thing is that the brothers and sisters of the earth, some have got there before the others and are raiding the larder. And eventually many of Mother Earth's resources will be used up. And many of our brothers and sisters won't even know that there was a larder. You think how precarious Mother Earth is. I believe the rivers are now in danger from pollution and other things. Some people travel miles and talk about global warming. From the very beginning, we have to remember that Mother Earth is the mother of all the living. And we need to share Mother's larder. Otherwise, we'd be in great trouble with the Lord, who gave us this earth for all to care for it. One of the rules of gardening is you'll only get out of Mother Earth what you put into it. So there is a theology of compost still to be written. That all our bits and pieces, instead of just being wasted, somehow need to be turned back to refresh Mother Earth, that poor thing can be exhausted just because some greedy people got there first. Ezekiel was talking about this. When people arrived at an oasis, first there, first served, they were all butting each other out with their rumps, muddying the waters for those who come after them. The whole earth is a commonwealth. Let's be careful not to squander the wealth, but to make sure that what wealth there is common. Amen.
That's all from the English feature program today, but we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.